The Lucas County Council Podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County Council Program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. More information at causakids.net.
Welcome to The Power of One, the Lucas County CASA podcast, where we explore how just one caring adult can make a life-changing difference for a child in the welfare system. I'm your host, Andrea de la Roca. Today, we're exploring an important and sometimes misunderstood topic, Planned Permanent Living Arrangements, or PPLAs. What happens when a child in foster care isn't likely to be adopted or reunited with their parents? And what role do CASA volunteers play in making sure these children still have the stability, guidance, and opportunities they need for the future? To help us answer these questions, I'm joined by two incredible guests, Mary Bonnet, CASA coach and emancipation specialist, has spent 47 years dedicated to child welfare, bringing a wealth of wisdom and experience to our conversation. Joining the discussion as well is Amy Cox, Lucas County Children's Services Independent Living Unit Supervisor, who works every day to ensure older youth in foster care are supported as they prepare to step into adulthood. Mary and Amy, thank you both for being here today.
Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you for having us.
So before we get into details of PPLA, let's take a moment for our listeners to get to know you better. This question is for both of you. What first inspired you to become involved in child welfare?
Well, Andrea, this is Mary. It happened a long, long time ago, way back when I was in high school. At Macaulay High School, we had a club called the Community Services Club, and I spent probably the whole of my junior and senior year at the Miami Children's Center, not knowing that I would spend the next 38 years of my life serving children and families.
Hi, this is Amy. I guess for me, I was on a different path. I was actually doing my internship with the University of Toledo at Juvenile Court for criminal justice. And as I was there, I kept seeing all of these kids who were coming in, and I had no idea, like I had no concept, I guess, really about foster care and what that meant and how many youth were actually in foster care. I saw a lot of teens sitting alone by themselves, and I was like, maybe this is something for me. So instead of working on the delinquency side at juvenile court, I started moving over toward the dependency side to see kind of what was going on. And that's when I decided, like, hey, these kids need to have a voice, and maybe I could be that person.
Can you share a little about your career journey and how it led you to the work you do today?
This is Mary. I started out at the Miami Children's Center, as I said earlier, in the recreation department. And then I was a house parent for teen girls, not too much older than they were at that time, and then moved into casework. My two longest positions at the agency were in the independent living unit for 17 years, and then in assessment department before I retired.
Okay, so you were in the same department as Amy.
Yes.
Okay.
Just many years ago. Yep.
So you will be able to see the differences that are happening now compared
Absolutely.
To what you were doing back
Absolutely.
Then, which is exciting.
Absolutely.
Because it's a lot of good things that are happening.
All right, this is Amy again. For me, after I interned, I got a job at the Youth Treatment Center. I wanted to get my foot in the door at the county when I was in grad school, and then I interned at Children's Services, and I was able to work alongside who's my mentor. His name is Mike Hiltman, and he worked with the youth that emancipated and part with the independent living unit. And I was like, that is where I want to be. So as soon as there was an opening, I switched from the Youth Treatment Center to Children's Services, and then I held various positions as an ongoing caseworker for about 4.5 years, and then in case review. And then finally, the supervisor position opened, and that's where I had to be. So I was super excited to get that opportunity. So now I've been there for about 5 years supervising that unit.
So how long in total have you been with the agency?
Ooh, like 12 years employed, but 14 because I had 2 years of internship. I couldn't get enough of it, so I came back for a second year.
Thank you, ladies. Okay, and on the flip side, what challenges have you faced that have shaped how you approach child welfare today?
This is Mary. I think the hardest things in dealing with children and families that come into care are when siblings are split, when adoptions disrupt, because that is not only a huge trauma for a child, but it's the second victimization that that child has to endure. And being in the assessment department, when I would meet families, parents who are so lost, who don't have any hope at all, those are really the tragic things that I've observed throughout the years.
Mm-hmm. For me, I think the most challenging time is now. We have a lot of young teenagers, young adults, who are really struggling with mental health and the services that we need. We have lots of mental health services, but their needs are so high that our community mental health isn't able to provide the services that they need. Some of them need a higher level of care, and it's very difficult to get them what they need so that we can get them stabilized to even be able to do the independent living work. So a lot of times we're moving them to try to find the right fit, to try to find the right person who can maybe reach them so we can stabilize them and then teach them all the skills that they need for when they emancipate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have 3 children. 2 of them are young adults, and it's been a learning experience for me. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine, you know, not having a parent, not having, you know, the closeness with somebody. So we definitely need a community that's very supportive. And understanding, too.
Yes, understanding is huge. It's also a different world out there. These kids have everything at their fingertips, and not all the information they receive from social media or wherever they're getting their information is correct. So we're always having to challenge, you know, these youth, because people are feeding them the wrong information and they believe it, and it creates that barrier for them to move forward in their success.
Yeah. What have been some of the most rewarding moments of you in advocating for children and families?
I would say that any time that there is permanence for children, no matter where that lays, if it is to be reunited with their birth family, or to be in the legal custody of a family friend or relative, adoption, or to age out of the agency and be safe and have everything that they need to succeed as a young adult.
Okay. This is Amy again. For me, it's a 2-part. I think graduation day is probably one of my most rewarding days at the agency. It gets you through all the hard times. Actually going to the graduations, because my co-supervisor, Dana, and I, we go to every single graduation for every graduate to make sure they have someone's face in the crowd. And then we throw a huge celebration for them. And I think just seeing the smiles on their face, seeing everybody that comes out to support them, it's really like life-changing for them to know that there's hundreds of people who care and are invested in them. And then the second part is after they've graduated, moved out, gone to college, wherever it is after they emancipate, watching them break that cycle, watching them continue to, you know, be substance-free or treating their mental health or having children of their own and not being involved with the agency. That's one of my favorite parts. I'm a grandmother to lots of teens who've had children and had the opportunity to be there when their children are born, or, you know, to get to visit with them and see that they've made it and they're not repeating that cycle and they're happy and they're healthy.
And Mary and I mean, we have attended the high school. I love attending the high school celebration.
It's amazing.
The graduation, it's the vibe, and then you guys do the parade. And the kids, you can tell they're so proud of themselves.
Yes.
Just how it's evolved from when I was in the unit to now, it's like baby steps to the grand finale.
Yes. I like to do it big, go big or go home.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
We so enjoyed it.
And I think now with the location, the new location, you know, where the agency's building is much easier, I think, for the parade. So would you agree or not?
I think it's hit or miss. We have a really good relationship with the Toledo Police Department,
who's
been able to, like, close down the street so that we can safely do our parade and stuff like that. So,
And it's usually, it's May, right?
When So all the graduations are end of May, and then we do our party the first or second week of June.
Okay.
So that we're not interfering with everyone's actual, like, ceremonies.
Yeah, and tell the audience a little bit about all the gifts, because that's huge, too. Mm-hmm. You guys do a lot for the kids.
So our agency is full of amazing individuals who donate so many gifts. So each unit at our agency sponsors a graduate, or sometimes two units get together, and they just spoil these individuals who are graduating. And then they have the opportunity to meet them, watch them open their gifts. Mm. And sometimes... it's taken a while to heal from what they've been through, and some of those faces may have been the caseworkers that removed them or have been out to foster homes and things like that. And to see them in a different light and be able to see, like, hey, you were there from the beginning, and now you're here at the end, and you're celebrating me is huge.
Yeah.
We started doing one lap for the parade, and then I noticed that the kids were kind of, like, nervous and scared, like they didn't know what to expect. So we did the second lap. So if you notice when you're watching the parade, the first lap, they're very reserved. The second lap, they're outside the car windows, like, woohoo, I did it. Like, just to get them, because they're so taken back by the number of people that are there supporting them.
Yeah.
It was so touching. And to see the foster parents who have done so much to help them. Mm-hmm. And the caseworkers and staff, administration, like, out there.
Yes.
Woo-hooing.
Yeah. And Mary also organized the volunteers who they're, you know, CASA child is graduating. And, you know, they come to the office and do the signs.
Make signs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Decorate the cars. You guys provide the stuff to decorate the cars.
We want to be supportive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And celebrate their accomplishment. Okay, how did you first become familiar with CASA volunteers, and what stands out to you about the role they play?
Well, I'm going to answer that. This is Mary, because Amy was probably not even born yet. The Lucas County CASA program started in 1980. We were the third CASA program in the United States. And when I was a caseworker, I first had one of the first CASAs, like, ever, and she was probably a CASA on two or three of my cases, and not because they didn't have enough volunteers at that time. Mm-hmm. I kind of didn't understand, like, of how they picked and choose the cases.
Okay.
But she was very influential, and as I saw, she was one of our award winners. Mm-hmm. Many, many years ago.
Who's that?
Her name was Regula Josie.
Mm-hmm.
She was a wonderful, wonderful woman.
Okay.
And brought a lot of volunteers in to become CASAs.
Okay, so you learn about the program because you were a caseworker.
I was a caseworker, yes.
And then how did you decide to join the team?
Well, when I was retiring from Children's Services, I got a call from the then director at Lucas County CASA, who asked me to apply for a part-time position. Mm. And to be honest, I wanted a break. I had some travel plans, and I said, I can't start. I have some things going on. And she said, we'll work with you. And I can't believe that 9 years later, this month, I have been there. And I call it my encore career. It's been absolutely wonderful. And the people I've met, and still have the opportunity to work with families and children, and see coworkers that I knew at Children's Services, just such as Amy.
Yeah.
And I normally cry when I see them because I miss them.
That is true. You did cry when you first saw me when you started over there.
Amy, how did you become aware of the CASA program?
I think the first time I became aware was when I was interning at juvenile court for my undergrad. I didn't really know their role or how important it was until I started working for the agency. And then I became more familiar and getting to meet different CASAs and working alongside of them to help our cases be successful, to help families reunify and all the things that come with it. So,
Mary and Amy, thank you for sharing, you know, your passion for children and families. We can tell it runs deep. You know, you have chosen this career path because you feel a call in your heart to make a difference for these children. So we thank you for that. In our next segment, we will learn more about PPLA.
My name is Amy Nelson, and I'm a CASA. I actually was reading the newspaper, and there was an ad for a informational meeting back in 2017, so I attended that at the Oregon Public Library. Getting to know the kids, hearing their stories, and just being a person that they can go to with their problems and just listen, and then also just giving them the chance to just be kids. The most rewarding thing is getting to know the kids and just spending time with them and focusing on what they like to do and what they like to talk about, and focusing on letting them be kids instead of worrying about all the things they have to worry about. It was the best decision I ever made. If you love kids, you're going to love this volunteer position. It's all worth it in the end.
Welcome back. Now let's set the stage for today's conversation. Amy, could you explain to our listeners what a planned permanent living arrangement is?
Yes. So it's a legal custody arrangement between like us and the parents. It allows a teenager to stay in foster care while parents remain, they get to keep some of their rights.
Okay. And why is it different from reunification, adoption, or guardianship?
So reunification would be the child would go home and the parents would get custody back of their child. Legal custody to like a relative is that relative would get custody and be able to maintain that child in their home. And then permanent custody is when a parent's rights are terminated. So they do not have rights to that child anymore.
How does being placed in a PPLA affect a young person's day-to-day life and long-term outlook?
So for PPLA, it's not just like a parent's choice. A child, when they turn 16, they have the right to decide if they want to be adopted, or if they don't want to be adopted, then we look at the PPLA. And that means they can emancipate out of foster care, so they'll stay in foster care long term. So they're a big role in deciding what that looks like for them.
Okay, so they have to be 16. So
yes.
That's the age. Okay. What about the circumstances where a PPLA becomes the most likely option for a child? So they have to be 16.
Correct.
And then
if the child cannot return home for whatever reason. So if the parents aren't able to complete their case plan services so the child can safely return to the home, or sometimes there are things that take place where it might be a risk for that child to return to the home, mm-hmm. then we come to the table, make a decision, and, you know, decide that it might be more stable for that child to remain in foster care until they emancipate.
What kind of support or services are available to young people in this type of arrangement?
So when youth enter PPLA or legal custody of the agency, their case transfers up to the independent living unit as worker of record. Prior to that, they have a support worker in independent living, but this new worker will be their worker until they emancipate. And then if they want post-emancipation services afterwards, we like to keep the same worker on so they have a continuity of care. And while they're in PPLA, they receive independent living services, so we're helping them prepare for what life after foster care will look like. Whether you're going to college, whether you want to enter the workforce, you're going to live on campus, you're going to get your own apartment. All of those things we help them prepare for. And at the same time, we're making sure they're linked to mental health services, any programs that offer like employment training so that they can be prepared for the workforce. We also have youth who have developmental delays, And those youth stay with us a little bit longer, sometimes up to the age of 21. So we work very closely with like the Lucas County Board of DD to help support those youth, the guardianship board, probate court to make sure that these youth are taken care of, and also the Social Security office to make sure they have financial resources to care for themselves. So we are dabbling in a lot of different spaces to make sure that these youth have everything that they need.
How many children are you serving right now?
We have over 200 kids in foster care, slightly over. Some of them are still in our temporary custody while we're figuring out what the plan is going to be in working case plan services. And then the other ones are in our either permanent custody or our PPLA.
Okay. Okay. So these 200 are only PPLA?
No. These are all the teenagers in foster care.
Oh, teens. And so 13 and up?
14 to 21.
14 to, okay.
Yep.
Okay. So when the court orders a PPLA, right, the child usually remains in long-term foster care or a residential setting with the goal of stability until adulthood. That can sound discouraging, but CASA volunteers have a critical role here. So let's talk about that. Mary, you work on cases where a child was placed in a PPLA. Can you share what that experience was like?
Andrea, that each child that has emancipated from Lucas County Children's Services, that their situations have all been very different. Some have gone on to college. Some have unfortunately left not a very good situation. Some have gone back to birth families. But all in all, that they were given the tools with Lucas County Children's Services and the court that if they did need more time to get the Bridges program in place or to get an apartment, to have all the support so they would not fall through the cracks, that we were all working together.
It sounds like relationships and stability become even more important in these cases. The following question is for Amy. What are some of the biggest challenges youth in PPLAs face, and how can the community help address those challenges?
I think this is a very good question. One of our biggest barriers is housing for our youth. Our youth have to work 20 hours a week or go to school 20 hours a week or a combination of both to be eligible for the Bridges program, which will help pay their rent. But trying to find a landlord or apartment complex that's willing to work with them because they have no credit, because they don't have a rental history, all of those things is very difficult a lot of times to get someone to take a chance on them. So that's one of our biggest issues. I think the second is trying to find positive role models in the community. A lot of our kids become very dependent on professional relationships, so we become their family, right? You know, we're the ones going to their sporting activities. They call us in the middle of the night when they're struggling with something. Like, we become their family, and we always try to be with them even after they emancipate, but we need more people in the community to wrap around them and help provide that support, because we can't be everything for everybody all of the time. Yeah. And I think the last piece is the sex trafficking and like the criminal behavior. We can't compete with the streets. We try to offer them skills. We have a stipend account where they can earn money for doing independent living activities. But a lot of these kids have been grown for a really long time in their own way. So it's very hard to come into foster care and have to have a curfew or have to have certain expectations and rules that they're just not used to having. So we do have a lot of kids that go AWOL. And my team is out searching for these kids all of the time. Day or night, it doesn't matter. We work really closely with the Toledo Police Department to help locate our kids, but we're always searching for them and always trying to bring them back into care. And then sometimes they run again because they can get quick money or things like that, and they don't understand that these other people in the community are taking advantage of them. So trying to like teach them those kinds of things. But I also think that trying to overcome the stereotype of foster care. So I say that trafficking is an issue and criminal behavior can sometimes be an issue, but that's not the majority of our youth. And I think that's the stereotype that a lot of our youth get. They don't graduate from high school. They're out here doing all these horrible things in the community. Those aren't our kids all of the time. Our kids graduate high school. We just had 20 graduates this past year. Our kids aren't all in the street committing crimes, doing those things. They're not going to rent an apartment from you and destroy the apartment. Like, those things are not true with our young adults. They're not going to get a job and mess up at the job just because they were in foster care. Mm-hmm. So I think if people would start seeing them as just normal kids who are in this situation at no fault of their own, but they've had a lot of trauma because of things that happened to them, they just need people to work with them and understand them instead of just kind of writing them off.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's huge. And that's the reason why I wanted this episode, because I feel like that's a population that we don't really talk about a lot, and they need as much love and support as the little ones. People mostly think, oh, you know, foster care, birth to like 6-7 years. No. Mm-hmm. Like, if anything, the teens, they might not tell you, I need a hug, but you can tell they need a hug.
Absolutely.
And I think, in some way, they need more love and attention, because the people who were supposed to love them and keep them safe didn't always foot the bill. So they're looking for that love and that safety in places, and sometimes it's not in the right place. So we're also having to teach them that. And that's a hard skill to teach people, trust, boundaries, you know, stuff like that.
Thank you for all the work that you do with the kids. Okay, Mary, from your perspective, what do magistrates or caseworkers most need from CASA volunteers in a PPLA case?
Since a CASA volunteer is the child's voice in court, it is the most important thing that our volunteers are out there monthly, bi-monthly, especially in crisis situations or in the later teen years, as emancipation is moving forward, to ensure that those youth are on the right track. And it's a combination of support between Lucas County Children's Services and Lucas County Juvenile Court to ensure the success. Like, for these young people, it's so important, Andrea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what challenges do you see CASA volunteers navigating in these cases?
Andrea, I think the hardest thing is to try to navigate the emotional toll it takes on our volunteers when permanency does not happen the way we want it to. I have been in our office when volunteers have come back from a termination hearing in tears because the child has walked away. And they know that that is not the best way, and the agency has done everything to make that not happen. But it is a reality. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it does happen.
A lot of times, they do walk away because they think they know the world, just like every other 18-year-old. Mm-hmm. But life is humbling. And when that time comes, they're able to call our agency, and we always provide that information so they can call and get post-emancipation services, and someone is assigned immediately to them and can help them. It's a little more difficult because now we can't house them because they're not in our custody, but we're able to come up with a plan and try to figure out, where can they go? Do they need employment? All of the things that they need, mental health services to be relinked again, whatever. We have a team who can do that up until their 21st birthday.
Oh, okay.
And it's the same team that has already worked with them, so they're familiar. Usually it takes about 30 to 90 days before one of our emancipated youth realizes, oh, man, being adult is not everything I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And then they come back.
So that's good for the community to know, mm-hmm. if they're working with a youth that was living in foster care, mm-hmm. they might be able to reach out to the agency and ask for these, you know, post-emancipation services.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's good. So one of the most powerful aspects of CASA advocacy is making sure the youth's own voice is heard. Mary, how have you supported a young person in expressing what they want in their PPLA case?
Through the Voices program, which is a voluntary program for our youth, they are able to come to court and speak to the magistrate alone or with their caseworker or with their CASA volunteer to share their wishes. When I have spoken to some of our youth about that, they'll say, oh, I'm not going to go to court. I don't want to go. I don't care about that. And then most of the times when the date comes closer to the court hearing, they'll say, "Can I still come?" Mm-hmm. And the magistrates and judges spend time with them, mm-hmm. with all of their busy schedules and the court docket. It really is a wonderful thing that our court does, yeah. to support our youth.
Yeah, I have experienced that with my own, you know, CASA child, and that was powerful to see them really invested and really wanted to hear, you know, what do you want for your life? How do you see yourself? How can we support you get to those goals? So.
Because I feel that they think that every decision has been made for them in their life, of whether they're 14 or 19 or aging out at age 21, that these decisions have been made for them all throughout their life, and they've had no voice. And to be able to sit down and to be part of the discussion, I think it's so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Amy, would you like to say something?
I think with the courts, the Voices program is amazing. A lot of our kids actually really like to talk to the magistrates, mm-hmm. and the judges when they have the opportunity to share their perspective. But also, like, taking that back with our agency, we have a youth advisory board. And that youth advisory board meets every other month. And they also travel to Columbus to advocate for changes, mm-hmm. within the foster care system. And then once a year, we take about 4 youth to the National Independent Living Conference, oh. where they get to network with other youth around the country.
Oh, wow.
And they get to talk about what changes they would like to see. And over the years, we've had some crazy changes that I thought that would never happen. So, for instance, we had a young lady who went to that national conference and was like, "We have the right to drive. And other kids in other states are driving, and we need to make this happen."
Oh.
And she wrote a letter to our executive director at the time, helped us come up with some of these policies that everyone at the agency felt comfortable with. And now we pay for driver's ed, we have licensed drivers, and we've even purchased vehicles for kids.
Oh,
so nice. It is amazing to see what one voice can rile everybody up to make that positive change.
Yeah, when you empower them.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's
great.
That
would never have happened when I was in the independent living unit.
But that's exciting
to see how much it
has grown, mm-hmm. to be really a huge support for these children. Because what
we want
is for them to be independent.
Absolutely. I mean, normalcy, every day they're advocating, "Miss Amy, I want to do this. How can we make this happen?" And mm-hmm. how do we support them to advocate for that? So, I mean, they're trying to change the world one day at a time, you know?
That's exciting. Okay, so even when permanency isn't adoption, or returning to their family of origin, we can still advocate for connection, belonging, and future success. That's what makes CASA Volunteers so vital. In our final segment, Mary and Amy will share some advice with us. Thank you for joining us. Today we're exploring an important topic: Planned Permanent Living Arrangements, or PPLAs. When the court orders a PPLA, the child usually remains in long-term foster care or a residential setting, with the goal of stability until adulthood. Can one of you share an example of a time when a young person in a PPLA really thrived because of the right support and advocacy?
So this is Amy. I can think of a specific teen who was able to get into credit recovery and maintain her placement because we found the right placement for her. We were also able to assist that youth with getting their STNAs, getting enrolled in college, purchasing a vehicle for that child, and then helping that child move into their own place. So when we had all the right things in place, we were able to set this youth up for success, which in the past we didn't have the opportunity to be able to do all the things that we can do today. I think that the breaking the cycle has really empowered, because this youth is a part of a SIB group. So they saw this youth do all these things, and now it's empowered their siblings to be able to do the same thing.
Yeah, they can see what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's exciting. For our listeners who are CASA volunteers considering working with older youth, Mary, what advice would you give about handling the unique challenges of a PPLA case? For our listeners who are CASA volunteers considering working with older youth, Mary, what advice would you give about handling the unique challenges of a PPLA case?
I would start off, Andrea, with making sure that the CASA volunteers knows that to never underestimate their own influence of the effect on a teen. You know, it's a tough population, but it's a wonderful population to work with. I have the best stories and the best memories of working, like, not only with all of the youth that I had in the past, but the young lady I'm working with now. It's a role that we have to be consistent to make sure that services are in place for our youth.
So I have one more question for each of you. So let's start with Amy. What do you wish more people understood about PPLAs, and how can that understanding help us better support the youth in these situations?
I think for me, I'd like the community to really understand that these kids do have support. I hear a lot of misconceptions that they're just kicked out of foster care and that there's no supports offered to them. That is not the case. We support them along the way. We support them through the transition and then even afterwards. We pride ourselves in our independent living unit on building good relationships with our kids and always being that support that they need. So that's the huge thing. Also, they are not their stereotypes. So any stereotypes you've heard about foster care, that is not our kids. I need people to kind of break that thought so that they can have normalcy, so they can get the support from the community they need, because these are our children as a community, mm-hmm. and we need to wrap around them and help them. I mean, I know we see on the news all the time that teens are in crisis right now, and we need to support them as much as we can. Also, if anyone wants to get involved with Youth Who Emancipate, we work with an amazing nonprofit called Love and Luggage, and they help support our youth who emancipate. They provide a meal every 6 to 8 weeks in which different community organizations help provide that meal. They offer mentorship, so you have the opportunity to mentor some youth in foster care. Anything that you could bring to the table. Sarah Otis and her husband Jim are amazing with our teens, and so are the rest of the volunteers there. So I think that's an amazing step to get involved. But if landlords are willing to rent to our kids, anything like that, they can always reach out to the agency, ask to speak to someone in independent living, and myself or Ms. Dana are always available to provide any information that anyone needs. But these kids really need the community to support them because they are our children.
If someone wants to volunteer with them, how can they contact them?
They can be reached at their website, loveandluggage.org. On that webpage, there is contact information for Ms. Sarah Otis. Her email and her phone number is on there to reach out to volunteer.
Okay, and if someone, let's say someone in the community is working with the youth and they found out, you know, this youth has emancipated and they feel that they seem lost, how can they contact your unit to get support?
We would prefer that the youth contact us because we can't share information that we worked with that youth. So if you could support them to call our intake line and just let that youth tell the intake worker that they need post-emancipation services, I will get an email within 20 minutes saying that this youth is in crisis and needs help.
Okay. And what is the number for that?
It's 419-213-CARE.
Okay. Okay, great. If anyone wants to learn more about the agencies, they can just go to lucaskids.net.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, cool. And Mary, the last question. For those listening who might be wondering if they could really make a difference as a CASA volunteer, what would you say to encourage them to take the first step?
Every child, no matter how young or how old, needs a voice, and you can be that voice for them. You won't regret it.
Planned permanent living arrangements are never the first choice. They often mean a young person has faced years of uncertainty, loss, and change. But what we heard today is that permanency is the beginning of hope. With the right advocacy, support, and connection, youth in PPLAs can still thrive, and CASA volunteers play a vital role in making sure they do not get lost in the system. CASA volunteers bring stability, consistency, and a trusted voice to a child's life. They remind young people that even when adoption or reunification is impossible, someone still believes in them, stands up for them, and makes sure their voice is heard. If today's conversation has moved you, I encourage you to take action. Visit CasaKids.net or call us at 419-213-6753 to learn more about becoming a CASA volunteer. Mary, thank you for sharing your decades of wisdom with us. And Amy, thank you for giving us a glimpse into the critical support your team provides. And to our listeners, thank you for spending time with us today on the Lucas County CASA podcast, The Power of One. I'm Andrea de la Roca. Until next time.
The Lucas County CASA podcast highlights how the power of one person can transform the lives of abused children in our community. This podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County CASA program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. All episodes are posted on WGTE.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more about the Lucas County CASA program at CASAKids.net.